be able to water at some well on the far side of the sands, and then slip away unobserved. I was certain that some of the Rashid would accompany me, and with them I should have the freedom of the desert. I therefore wired to Shepherd at Mukalla, asking him to send a messenger to Bin Kabina at Habarut, telling him, Bin Al-Kaman, and Bin Gabesha to meet me in the Hadramut at the time of the new moon in November. If I kept the party small, I could pay for the journey with the money I had saved. The future could take care of itself. I arrived in Mukalla on the 3rd of November, and, after staying for a few days with Shepherd and collecting the rifles and ammunition which I had left with him the year before, I went up to Saiwun, where I stayed with Watts, the political officer. Watts was having trouble with the Manor Hill. Some of them, led by my old friend Bin Dualin, the cat, had recently surprised two government posts in the Hadramut and captured a large number of rifles and much ammunition. One Bedou legionary had been killed. Since Bin Dualin refused to hand back the rifles, Watts had forbidden any of the Manor Hill to come into the towns. As there was no news of Bin Kabina and the others, I decided to travel for a fortnight in the Saar country before I started on my journey across the sands, in order to link up the traverses which I had made in southern Arabia between the Halfain and the Hadramut, with Philby's work in 1936 along the Yemen border. The Saar, a large and powerful tribe, have been aptly described as the wolves of the desert. They were hated and feared by all the South Arabian desert tribes, whom they harried unmercifully, raiding as far eastward as Mukshin and the Jadat al-Harasis, and northwards to the Yam, the Dawasir and the Mura. Boscan had hunted oryx in their country in 1931, and Ingrams paid a cursory visit to the edge of their territory in 1934. Otherwise, no Englishman had been there. Watts found in Shibam two Saar who said they would take me into their country. They had two camels with them, both of which were bulls, for the Saar, like the Humum, own large numbers of bull camels, which they hire for carrying goods to towns in the Hadramut. One of them, called Salim, was a lively little man in a blue loincloth. The other was tall and was called Ahmad. He was dressed in a white shirt, rather short for him, and his dour appearance belied a friendly spirit. Both were armed with Martini rifles. We went up to Raidat al-Saar, a shallow valley about 200 yards across, running through a barren limestone plateau. On the low cliffs which enclosed it were stone buildings and watchtowers, many of them empty. Ahmad told me that their inhabitants had died in the Great Famine in 1943. The terraced valley was green with crops of sorghum and beans, planted on floods in July. And there were clumps of date palms, and many ilb trees. Raidat is the heart of the Saar country, but lacks permanent water. The inhabitants had recently tried to dig a well, but had abandoned it when they failed to find water at 60 feet. In the Saar country, there are only two permanent wells, one at Manwak, about 180 feet deep, and the other at Zamak, which they told me was 240 feet deep. The Saar, many of whom were collected in the Raidat to harvest the crops, had heard of me as a result of my wanderings in southern Arabia, and welcomed me with great friendliness. I found them a pleasant, virile people, without the corroding avarice of the Beit Katir. Other tribes call them treacherous, but this is probably a slander inspired by dislike. However, their reputation for godlessness is well merited in Arab eyes, since they neither fast nor pray, saying that the Prophet Muhammad gave their forefathers a dispensation from both. Like all the southern Bedou, they are a small, lightly built race. A few wore rags round their heads, but most of them were bareheaded. They were dressed only in loincloths, many of which were dyed with indigo. All the men and most of the boys wore daggers, and nearly everyone carried a rifle. Leaving the Raidat, we passed the grave of a woman saint, known as Walia Rikaya. This place was a sanctuary whose limits, about 100 yards round the tomb, were marked by cairns of whitened stones. Salim and Ahmad walked round the grave, kissed their right hands after touching all three of the upright stones, and then rubbed dust on their foreheads. We left some coffee beans in a stone shelter beside the tomb. There are many shrines in this country, and it is the custom for any passer-by who can do so to leave an offering of coffee. Other travellers who are weary can then use this offering, and the necessary utensils are kept inside the shrine. The Sa generally flavour their coffee strongly with ginger. When they serve it, they fill the cup, which is usually large and made of local earthenware. But the man to whom the cup is handed is expected to take only a few sips, and then hand it back to the server, who fills it up again and hands it to the next person. We visited the well at Manwak, in the Aiwat al-Sa, which drains to the sands, and of which the Raidat is a tributary. I was glad to have a look at this well, knowing that I must start my journey across the empty quarter, either from it or from Zamak. We found some Sa watering camels and goats. The water was fresh, and I noticed that they mixed rock salt in it before watering their camels. They raised the water by hand, the long ropes of palmetto fibre running over pulleys, attached to a wooden scaffolding round the well. The southern Bedou do not use camels to draw the well ropes, as is done on the deep wells in the Najd, although villagers in the Hadramut use camels and oxen to raise the trip buckets from which they water their cultivations. After they had finished watering, they took their ropes, pulleys, and leather watering troughs away with them. There was a very lovely girl working with the others on the well. Her hair was braided, except where it was cut in a fringe across her forehead, and fell in a curtain of small plaits round her neck. She wore various silver ornaments and several necklaces, some of large cornelians, others of small white beads. Round her waist she had half a dozen silver chains, and above them her sleeveless blue tunic gaped open to show small, firm breasts. She was very fair. When she saw I was trying to take a photograph of her, she screwed up her face and stuck out her tongue at me. Salim, thinking to help me, had told her not to move and explained what I was doing. During the following days both he and Ahmad chaffed me whenever I was silent, saying that I was thinking of the girl at Manwak, which was frequently true. The Tsar told me some Rashid were camped nearby. We went over to them next day and found one-eyed Abdullah Muhammad, who was Bin Kalut's son, and some Awamir and Mara sheikhs. When I was close they fired shots low over my head, their usual greeting for sheikhs or other distinguished people. About 40 Sa were with them, discussing the renewal of a truce with the Rashid. Muhammad told me that Bin Kabina had received my letter at Habarut, and that he had ridden down to Gaidat on the coast to find someone to translate it. I knew that it was at least 100 miles from Habarut to Gaidat, and realized this extra distance would account for his not having arrived yet. However, it was good to know that he was on the way. Muhammad also told me that Bin al-Kamam was still in the Yemen, negotiating with the Dam for the return of the Rashid camels, and that Bin Gabesha was in Darfur. Taking me aside, he asked where I was going, and I told him, but begged him to keep it secret, since I knew that it would be dangerous if the tribes learnt of my movements in advance. He volunteered to come with me, and I accepted his offer, as it seemed unlikely that I should be able to get hold of either Bin al-Kamam or Bin Gabesha. We agreed to meet in the Raidat at the time of the next new moon. He could not come with me now, as the discussions with the Tsar would go on for some days. He told me news had just arrived that the Manahil had again raided the Yam. It had been a big raid of 140 men, and they had killed 10 Yam and lifted 150 camels. 9 of the Manahil had been killed, including Bin Dualin, who had led the raid. Later, I was to hear the story of his death from the man who killed him. This was very bad news, for it meant that there were almost certain to be large-scale retaliatory raids by the Yam, and probably by the Dawasir, several of whom had recently been killed in a raid by the Tsar. If we crossed the sands, we should have to water in the Dawasir country near Sulayr. and I knew from the inquiries I had made at Nadsran a few months earlier that the Yam pastured their herds during the winter in the sands to the south of Saleo. We could not possibly find a rabia from either of these tribes, and both tribes would now consider themselves at war with my companions. The news here was all of raids and rumours of raids. Muhammad and Abdullah were worried about a force of 150 Abida from the Yemen, which had passed eastwards along the edge of the sands a fortnight earlier. They had heard that the leader of this raid was Murzuk, a renegade Saar who lived with the Abida. I knew that Murzuk had a formidable reputation as a raider and a bitter hatred for the Miskas, the collective name for the tribes who lived to the east of the Saar. The desert was more disturbed than it had been for years. Muhammad pressed me to spend the night with them, but I was anxious to get back to the Hadramut now that I knew that Bin Kabina had received my message. 2 days later, we were near Tamis Well, which belongs to the Awamir. This was dangerous border country. Ahmed went on ahead to scout as we approached the well. A little later he came back and signalled to us to be quiet and to stay where we were. When he got up to us, he told us that a large party of Manahil were coming up the main valley. I went with him to look. He warned me to keep well out of sight, since he said the Manahil hated the Saar, and that after their attacks on the government posts in the Hadramut, they might well feel that they were at war with the Christians. He added that, anyway, they were raiders who had suffered losses and would be in a savage mood. Peering cautiously between some rocks, I saw about 20 men just disappearing round a corner, a quarter of a mile away. They were driving some camels with them, and were riding in silence, with their rifles in their hands. They were naked except for their dark blue loincloths. If they had been 10 minutes later, they would have found us on the well. We remained where we were till late in the afternoon, and then, after Ahmad had looked to see that there was no one about, we went up to fill our waterskins. There were fresh tracks everywhere. Ali said he had seen about 40 mounted men, with about 30 captured camels, and explained that the main party would have split up into several groups after the raid in order to make pursuit more difficult. There was excellent water at 15 feet, in a hole in the rock. A loophole sangar overlooked it from the cliff immediately above. Although it was getting late, we went on again after filling our waterskins, so as not to camp near the well, always a dangerous thing to do in disturbed country. We found a shallow cave and stopped there, since the weather was cloudy and looked like rain. After dinner, as we were making tea and chatting quietly, a voice suddenly said, "Salam alaikum." We grabbed our rifles, which were beside us, unable, owing to the firelight, to see into the darkness. I answered, and a mare dropped off his camel and came forward to greet us. He told me that he had come with Bin Kabina from Habarut, and that Bin Kabina had foundered his camel and had stopped with Muhammad to await my return. He explained that Bin Kabina had ridden to Gaidat, and then, after he had found out what was in the letter, had ridden back to tell his mother and young Saeed where he was going. I realized that he must have ridden 900 miles, and I was not surprised that his camel had collapsed. I asked Amir for news of Bin Gabesha, and he said that he was with his father at Mudhayu. Later I asked him if he thought that Bin Gabesha would fly to Makala from Salalah, if I could arrange it. But he said, "No, he is only a boy. If you were with him he might go in an aeroplane, but he won't go by himself with the Christians." On our way back to Saiwum, we passed the palm groves at Kuf, the original homeland of the Awamir. Although most of this tribe, like their allies the Rashid, now live in the sands. 13 days after leaving Shibam, we camped once more on the plateau above the Hadramut. We have travelled 225 miles. For the last 3 days, the sky had been overcast, and that night we saw continuous flickers of lightning far away to the north. Amir watched with intent eyes, and several times exclaimed, "God willing, we will have a year of plenty." Next morning, we scrambled down the high cliffs into the Hadramut itself. Below us, we could see the Sultan's palace at Saiwun, massive and very white above the dark wall of palms. Other buildings, too, with crenellated towers and minarets and glistening domes, stood among green fields and gardens filled with fruit trees. I always felt imprisoned in the Hadramut. I should have been interested to see it 10 years earlier, before Ingrams had established law and order, for it was very old, a fragment from a vanished world that had survived in this remote valley. But now the spoiling hand of progress was on the land. Already some of the richer and more ostentatious Saïds in Tarim and Saiwun had built themselves houses which were as hideous as they were incongruous, furnished at great cost with modern conveniences. The year before, in Tarim, I had experienced how embarrassing it could be to use a lavatory, which, intended only for display, was not connected with anything. These houses were much admired, and would, I knew, be assiduously copied. Soon this new style would oust the local architecture, which, although harmonious and beautiful, was suddenly no longer fashionable, simply because it had lasted unchanged for centuries. I had been told that the late Shah of Persia divided everything in his realm into moderne and demodé, and gave orders for the demodé to be replaced. The same process would happen here. Walking through Saiwun, the largest town in the Hadramut, with about 20,000 inhabitants, I felt that it would not be long before there were cinemas and wirelesses blaring at street corners. Watts was on leave in Aden, but I stayed with Johnson, his assistant. Despite Amar's scepticism, I sent a telegram to the air officer commanding at Aden. I asked whether the CO at Salalah could get hold of Bin Gabesha through the Wali, and, if he was successful, whether Bin Gabesha could be flown to Rian and then sent up to Saiwun by car. A week later, I got a reply. Bin Gabesha contacted, stop, leaving by air for Rian tomorrow. 2 days later, Johnson was entertaining the Saiwun and Tarim football teams to tea in his house. I had watched with sardonic amusement as they had rushed about kicking a football to cries of, "Well played!" and "Pass, pass!" I was busy handing cakes to the Tarim centre-forward when I heard a well-known voice saying, "Salam alaikum!" And in walked Bin Gabesha. He was wearing his dagger and carried a camel stick. He had nothing else with him. He sat down beside me, and I asked him where he had come from. "We were near Mudhal in the wadi where you stopped on your way to Mukalla," he said. "I and my brother were herding our camels, when one of the wali's slaves arrived. You remember him, Abdullah, the young one who went with you to Jabal Qara? The slave said that you had arrived, and that the wali had sent for me. So I told my brother to take the camels back in the evening, and to tell my father I had gone to Salalah. When I got there, I went in to see the wali in the palace. He said to me, 'Mubarak is in the Hadramut and has sent for you. An aeroplane is going there tomorrow. Will you go there in it?' I interrupted to ask what his answer had been. He replied, I said, 'Why would I not go in an aeroplane?' The wali then sent me to the Christians' camp. The Christians gave me food, horrid stuff. I did not like it. I slept there, and next afternoon the aeroplane arrived. I asked, 'Had you ever seen an aeroplane before?' And he answered, 'Yes, on my way back from Mukalla last year. It was very high up, but it made more noise than this one. When I got into the aeroplane, the Christians tried to tie me with a rope. I would not let them.' I asked him how he had liked flying. He said, 'It was all right when we flew over the ground. I could see the wadis and hills. I knew where I was. By God, Mubarak, once I saw men and camels, very small, like ants. I was frightened when we flew over the sea. When it got dark, I thought the Christians had lost their way. They all began to chatter and wave their arms about. When we arrived at Rian, an Arab interpreter said that I was to go to Aden in the morning. The man was a fool, so I went to one of the Christians who had driven the aeroplane. I told him you were in the Hadramut. At first none of them could understand me, but at last they said, "Awa, awa, Mubarak, Hadramut," and hit me on the back and then gave me tea and bread. They had put milk in the tea and I would not drink it. This morning they mounted me on a lorry, and now I'm here.' He asked me where I was going, and I told him that I planned to cross the empty quarter to the Wadi Dawasir, and to go from there to the Trucial coast. All he said was, "I have not got a rifle." So I took him into my room and told him to choose one of the 5 rifles there. When he had chosen one, I told him it was a present. We spent 2 days in Shibam, the most interesting of these towns. Built on the edge of the dry riverbed, on a low mound in the middle of the valley, it had a population of about 7,000. The town is surrounded by a high wall, but this is dwarfed by the close-packed houses, which rise inside it to 7 or 8 stories. Whenever I was in the silent alleyways, under the sheer walls of these houses, I felt as if I were at the bottom of a well. Here Amer and Bin Gabesha arranged with the Tsar for camels to take us to the Raidat, and bought such things as we still required. I had brought flour, rice, sugar, tea, and coffee from Makalla, and we now purchased dried shark meat, butter, spices, saddlebags, ropes, and waterskins. I bought the waterskins myself, and among them I was palmed off with several sheepskins, which invariably sweat when filled with water. This would not have happened if Amer or Ben Gabesha had been with me, but they were busy elsewhere. We left Shibam on the 17th of December, and went up to Raidat. Ali bin Sulaiman, of the Hatim section of the Tsar, who was with us, was to be extremely helpful. The land was filled with rumours and alarms. Abdullah bin Nura, usually known by his family name of bin Makal, had recently arrived at Manwak with the bin Maruf Tsar. Although these bin Maruf belonged to the Hatim section of the Tsar, they no longer lived upon the Tsar plateau, but in the sands and steppes to the north, and for 12 years had acknowledged Ibn Saud as their overlord, and paid him tribute through the Amir at Najran. They were grazing their herds in the desert south of Najran, when word reached them that the Yam and Dawasir were massing, having been authorized by Ibn Saud to attack the Tsar and other Hadramut tribes, in retaliation for the recent raids in which some of them had been implicated. They therefore fled southward to seek refuge among their kinsmen. We now heard that advance parties of the Yam had already entered the Karab country to the west of us, lifting 700 camels and killing any Arabs whom they met. Some Tsar women with whom we spoke had seen them and described their clothes, saying that they wore trousers like women. This was convincing proof that they were from the north. The Tsar had evacuated the country between Al-Abra and Zamak, and it seemed probable that they would also abandon Manwak and withdraw into the broken country along the middle Makia. It was important for me to reach this well before they deserted it, if I was to find guides and camels for my journey across the sands. I left the Raidat at once and arrived at Manwak late in the evening of the 28th of December. There was no one near the well. As we had had a long day, we decided to camp nearby. At sunset, 6 bin Maruf came past. They were all young men and rode magnificent camels. They were worried by some camel tracks which they had found farther up the valley. These they had been unable to identify, and they feared they might be tracks of Yam scouts. For Bedu pushed scouts out far ahead to locate an encampment, and then, after an all-night march, fall on it at dawn. They told us that Bin Makal was 2 hours away, and advised us not to camp where we were. We did not wish to arrive at the Tsar encampment in the dark, so we decided to move into a side valley, and spent the night there. I sent Amer to tell Mohammed and Bin Kabina that we had arrived. Having camped, I think we all wished we had gone on after all, for the low rocky bluffs and empty plain looked menacing in the dying light, and made us feel very lonely. We cooked a quick meal, and then put out the fire. Ali advised us not to talk. In the night, one of our camels suddenly got to its feet. I had been lightly asleep, and in a second was awake. The others crouched about me, their rifles pointing into the darkness. Ali said, "It is only the camel," and seizing its head rope, jerked at it until the grumbling animal subsided once more upon its knees. We lay down again, tense after this alarm. In the sharp cold of the winter morning, we rode to the Saar camp, passing herds of fat milch camels, which the herds boys had just driven out to pasture. Small, black, goat-hair tents were scattered about the valley. Naked infants romped round them, and dark-clad women sat churning butter or moved about getting sticks or herding goats. I noticed with anxiety that several families had already struck their tents and loaded their camels. The small children were seated in camel litters, the first I had seen in southern Arabia, though I was familiar with them in the north. I hoped these preparations did not mean that the Saar were leaving Manwak. As we approached, the Bin Maruf formed up to receive us, and greeted us by firing low over our heads, before sweeping down on us, yelling and brandishing their daggers. We got off our camels to greet their sheikhs, and some Karab, Manahil, and Mara who were with them. A little apart from the others was a group of four or five so-called Sayyids. They had come up here from the Hadramut, hoping no doubt to profit from the credulity of the Saar, who would unhesitatingly accept their improbable claims that they were descended from the Prophet. Their pallid indoor faces seemed to me as out of place in this gathering of weathered tribesmen as did their clothes, which were of the Indonesian style, fashionable in the towns of the Hadramut. Bin Kabina had led the wild rush which welcomed us, and I was glad indeed to see him. He looked well, but his shirt was in ribbons. There were, however, new clothes for him in my saddlebags. After we had drunk coffee and exchanged our news, we chose a camping place nearby, where low-growing bushes and a bank of drifted sand gave us a little shelter from the cold north wind. We were still unloading when a dozen Saar came racing across the low dunes, their camels travelling at about 18 miles an hour, were urged on by the wild yells of their riders who rode them with effortless mastery. The camels swept forward across the undulating ground with raking, pounding strides, their necks stretched out low in front of them as they surged up to the crests and swept down into the hollows. But there was nothing ungainly about these great beasts, which moved as gracefully as galloping horses. The lads who rode them were among the finest in the tribe, lithe, hard-bodied, and alert. They were the scouts who went out at dawn to scour the desert, alert for the tracks of strangers. Hearing shots, they had supposed that the camp was being attacked, and had ridden back to help. At first sight, these Bin Maruf were very different from the other Saar. They wore long white shirts, cut with pointed sleeves, which reached to the ground, and headcloths and headropes of northern fashion. They were distinguished, too, by the herds of she-camels which they kept for breeding and for milk. All their camels were in excellent condition, for they had been on rich grazing near Najran. We required 9 camels, and next day my Rashid wandered round the encampments making inquiries. We knew that we should have to pay high prices, for we could get them nowhere else, and we were in a hurry. We each of us needed a riding camel, as Muhammad, Bin Kabina, and Amer had decided to leave theirs, which were in poor condition, with some Manahil who were here on a visit. I decided to buy 4 baggage camels, since we should have a very long way to go before we reached the Trucial coast. Bin Gabesha, who was a good judge, soon found himself a black hazmir for the equivalent of £15. We chaffed him about his choice, for there is a prejudice against riding these black camels. But he said that she was a fine animal, which she was, and that he needed her for work and not for display. Whenever anyone approached her, she flipped her tail up and down in a ridiculous manner, a sign that she had recently been served successfully. Bin Kabina bought a young grey with a very long stride. She was 6 months gone in calf, but this would not matter since camels carry their young for a year. Gradually, we collected the number we needed. I bought a small thoroughbred from Oman, a very willing animal, but with an irritatingly short stride. We also needed saddles and headropes. The woolen headropes were difficult to come by. A Sayyid had an old one which he sold to Bin Gabesha for the equivalent of 10 shillings. It was worth less than a shilling. The same man sold my Rashid various other things, overcharging them in each case. It happened that 2 days later he got conjunctivitis, and came to me scarcely able to see, as I sat with a crowd of Arabs. Brusquely he demanded medicine. I told him I should be delighted to treat him, but would require 5 shillings for each eye. He turned to the crowd and said, "Does the Christian not know I am a Sa'id, a descendant of Muhammad?" I said I was aware of this, but it did not alter my charges for treating him. He went away muttering angrily, but the pain drove him back. I took his money and was able to cure his eyes. This is the only time I have ever charged for doctoring anyone. We needed a guide. Ali told me that Bin Dasan, a middle-aged man from the Bin Maruf, knew these western sands better than anyone else. We spent several evenings in Bin Dasan's tent, trying to persuade him to come with us. I offered him money and a rifle, but avarice fought a losing battle in his mind, with the caution that comes with middle age. Each night, by the time we left him, he would have agreed to come with us, but in the morning we would get a message saying that his family refused to agree. Everyone assured us that we should certainly be killed by the Yam or the Dawasir as soon as we met them on the far side of the sands. They told us that 3 large parties of Yam were even then raiding round Al-Abr, and had killed 2 Sa'ar a few days ago. They said contemptuously that my Rashid were too young and inexperienced to know what lay ahead of us. Young they certainly were, for Muhammad was perhaps 25 years old, a mere 20, and Bin Kabina and Bin Gabesha 17. Yet they refused to be intimidated or to desert me. Muhammad suggested one evening that instead of crossing to the Wadi Dawasir, we should cross the sands farther to the east through Dakaka. But when I told him that Thomas and Philby had already been there, and that it was the western sands that I wished to explore, he said, "Don't worry. We will go with you wherever you want to go, whatever the Sa'ar may say." However, we agreed that we must get hold of a Sa'ar to come with us, so as to have protection from that tribe. Many of the Sa'ar, who hate the Rashid, were talking almost openly of following us when we left and killing us in the sands. Not only were there bitter scores to settle between these 2 tribes, but they knew that I had a lot of money with me, as well as our rifles, ammunition, and camels. Our Manahil friends warned us against going without a Sa'ar Rabia, and yet where were we to get one? 2 young Karab had volunteered to come with us, but they neither knew these sands, nor would their presence protect us from the Sa'ar. Ali and I went back again to Bin Dasan, and at last, after I had offered him more money, he agreed to accompany us. We arranged to water our camels and fill our water skins next day, and to leave the day after that. Next morning, as we were getting ready, a Maha arrived from Shagham Well, in the nearby Makia, with news of Bin Muzuk and the Abida raiders. They had looted the Rashid and Manahil and captured many camels, and killed 2 Rashid herdsmen. The Mara told us that the Abida had themselves been surprised while watering in the dark on Thamud Well, and that 5 of them had been killed, but that the pursuit party, which was small, had been driven off. He had seen and spoken with the Abida at Shagham 2 days before. They had 2 very badly wounded men with them, and were consequently moving slowly on their way back to their own country, angry at their losses. He advised us to wait for a few days before we started. Though I was almost superstitiously unwilling to put off our departure, now that Bin Dasan had at last made up his mind to go with us, I realized that there was nothing else to do. Everyone assured me that the raiders under Bin Muzuk would follow us and kill us without mercy, if they or any other Abida who were behind them crossed our tracks. The pursuit party had used as their battle cry, "Muzuk ya Talabta," death to Muzuk, a battle cry obviously invented for the occasion. And this, for some reason, convinced the Rashid that the pursuers had been from their own tribe, and neither Manahil nor Marwa. They were desperately anxious for every scrap of information about the raid, and especially about one of the pursuers who had been killed in the fight at Thamud. The Mara repeated to them the description of this man, as he had heard it from the Abida, and he also described his rifle which he had seen. Muhammad and the others said, "It is Salim bin Matluk, Without a doubt it is Selim. But they were puzzled by the description of the rifle, which they said belonged to no one in their tribe. For weeks they were to discuss this question, hoping against hope that it was not Selim bin Mafluk who had been killed. We did not hear what had happened until a year later on the Trucial coast. About 25 Rashid and a few Mara had followed the Abida and found them watering their camels at Thamud. They knew that water was short, and that, as the Abida numbered about 150, they would be all night watering their animals. They had crept towards the well. It was a cloudy night, and they had got close before they were challenged. They fired a volley and then rushed the Abida using their daggers. Hopelessly outnumbered, they were soon driven back. When they collected again, where they had left their camels, they found that Selim was missing. A Mara said that he had been killed near the well and produced his rifle. He explained that he had picked it up, leaving his own rifle, which was no good. Saud, Salim's brother, said at once that he was going back, and the others went with him. When they reached the well, there was no one there and no sign of Selim. At dawn, they followed the tracks which he had made as he had crawled away. They found him a mile away, unconscious, shot through the chest and neck. When he recovered consciousness, he told them that a fatally wounded Abida had called out, "Is there not one of them dead that I may look on him before I die?" And that someone had then seized him by the legs and dragged him over to the dying man, round whom many people were collected. The dying man had cursed him, and then someone had shot him again. When he came to, there was no one there, and he had crawled off into the dark, trying to get to the place where the Rashid had left their camels. He recovered from his wounds a few months afterwards. 2 days later, we went to the well at Manwak, bin Dasan having assured us again the night before that he was coming with us. We arranged with him to leave next day, and he said he would meet us on the well. We travelled there with a family that was camped near us. They said we could use their gear for watering. The man rode a camel loaded with great coils of rope, with pulleys, well buckets, rolled-up water-skins, and a large watering trough, fashioned from skins stretched over a framework of wooden hoops. His son rode bareback on one of 7 camels, and a woman and 2 small children drove a herd of goats. Others, too, were going down to the water. It was 6 miles away, and we took 2 hours to get there. When we arrived, there was already a crowd round the well mouth. Men and women drew on the ropes together, singing as they pulled hand over hand. On each rope, as one bucket jerked up from the dark depths, slopping water down the glistening walls, another descended empty. Each clammy, dripping leather bucket was seized as it reached the scaffolding, and hastily tipped into a trough, round which moaning camels jostled in haste to quench their thirst. Rows of bulging black skins lay upon the sand, guarded from the trampling feet of men and beasts by shrill-voiced children. Camels were watered, couched, and later driven away. Others arrived, breaking into a shuffling trot as they approached. Colts frisked, stiff-legged, around their dams. Men shouted with harsh voices to watchful, darting herdsboys. Goats bleated, camels roared, the singing at the wellhead rose and fell, the sun climbed higher, and the dark stain of spilt water spread farther across the ground. Abdullah bin Nura and several elders arrived. They told us that they would not allow bin Dasan or anyone else from the bin Maruf to go with us, and advised us to give up our plan to cross the sands, as the yam would certainly kill us if we did. I had half expected bin Dasan to let me down. We answered little and went apart to talk it over. Ali suggested that 2 young Sa'ar from his own section of the Hatim might go with us if I gave each of them a rifle and 50 cartridges. They had never crossed the sands, but had watered at the Hasi near Sulayl, and were confident that they could find the well once we had arrived on the other side. He said that if they were with us, we should be safe from the Sa'ar. I asked the Rashid what they thought, and Muhammad answered, "We are your men. We will go where you go. It is for you to decide." I told bin Kabina to make coffee while I thought it over, and we went and sat beneath the cliff, where we had unloaded our camels. It seemed crazy to try to cross the empty quarter without a guide. It was about 400 waterless miles, which would take at least 16 days, and Bindai-san had told me that the dunes were very high and difficult. I remembered how hard had been the journey which we had done the year before, and how little margin we had to spare, even when guided by Al-Auf. I asked the Rashid if they thought we could get across without a guide, and Muhammad said, "We live in the sands. We can take you across without a guide. The danger will be from the Yam after we have got to the other side." I told Ali that we would go, and asked him to fetch the two Saar, and he said he would bring them in the evening. Unlike my companions, I was far more concerned with the physical difficulties of crossing the empty quarter, especially without a guide, than worried by what would happen to us if we ran into Arabs on the far side. I did not think that they would take us for raiders, since we would be leading 4 laden camels. I knew that our clothes and saddling would show them that we came from the south and belonged to the hated Mishkas. But I hoped to be able to get speech with any Arabs we might meet before they opened fire, and if they belonged to Ibn Saud, I thought they might hesitate to kill us once they discovered I was a European, for fear of the king's anger. I knew that if they were from the Yemen, we should be doomed. Looking back on the journey, I realize how hopelessly I underestimated the danger, and how very slight were our chances of survival. It was midday by now, and there was still a crowd of people on the well which had run dry. We therefore decided to stop to fill our water skins during the night, and to water our camels at dawn before the Arabs arrived. We could camp in a little gully out of sight. Manwak was one of the only two wells which were regarded as having permanent water in the Saar country, an area larger than Yorkshire. Yet now it had run dry, after watering a couple of hundred camels, even though there had been a good rain 6 months earlier in the year. I wondered how the Saar managed for water in the summer and in years of drought. In the evening, Ali came to our camping place with the two men who had agreed to go with us to the Hasi. They were called Salih and Sada, and were about the same age as Muhammad. Salih had a large wart on his right eyebrow, wore his hair in plaits, and was dressed in a white shirt with long pointed sleeves, whereas Sada, the smaller of the two, wore his hair short and was dressed in a worn-out shirt, patched with so many different colours that it looked like a dervish jibba. They told us that they had been to the Hasi, from Najran, the year before, and were certain that they would be able to find this well as soon as we reached the Arad, a limestone escarpment running down into the sands from Sulayl. They said it would be impossible for us to miss. In the evening they went back to their tents, but assured us that they would be with us at dawn. After we had fed, the others took the water skins over to the well to fill them ready for the morning start. Ordinarily, I would have helped them, but now I was drained of energy, so I just lay beside the loads on the cold, yielding sand and stared up at the stars. Later, Bin Kabina came and sat beside me. He did not speak, and I was glad to have him there. Sada had told us that Ibn Saud had a post at the Hasi, and it therefore seemed unlikely that we should be able to water there and slip away again unobserved. I wondered what the king would say when he heard that I had crossed the desert without his permission, and whether he would identify me as the Englishman to whom he had refused permission to do the journey 2 years before. I only hoped that if we succeeded, his anger would be tempered by some admiration for our achievement. 11. The Second Crossing of the Empty Quarter. The crossing of the western sands to the Hasi Well and Sulayl ends in arrest and imprisonment. It was a bleak morning with a cold wind blowing from the northeast. The sun rose in a dusty sky but gave no warmth. Bin Kabina set out dates and fragments of bread, left over from the previous night, before calling to us to come and eat. I refused, having no desire for food, and remained where I was, crouching behind a rock, trying to find shelter from the cutting wind and eddies of driven sand. I had slept little the night before, trying to assess the dangers and difficulties which lay ahead. Later, in grey borderlands of sleep, I had struggled knee-deep in shifting sand, with nightmares of disaster. Now, in the cold dawn, I questioned my right to take these men who trusted me to what the Tsar vowed was certain death. They were already moving about their tasks, preparatory to setting off, and only an order from me would stop them. But I was drifting forward, slack-willed, upon a movement which I had started, half hoping that Salih and Sada would fail to come, and that then we could not start. Some Tsar were already at the well, which would soon be surrounded by Arabs impatient to water their animals. We drove ours down there and filled the troughs, but they would only sniff at the ice-cold water instead of drinking, and drink they must if they were to survive for 16 waterless days, struggling heavily loaded through the sands. Bin Kabina and I went back to sort the loads, while the others couched each roaring camel in turn, and, after tying her knees to prevent her from getting up, battled to hold her weaving neck, so that they could pour down her throat the water she did not want. Bin Kabina set aside the rice and the extra flour to give to Ali. We were taking with us 200 pounds of flour, which was as much as we could carry, a 40-pound package of dates, 10 pounds of dried shark meat, and butter, sugar, tea, coffee, salt, dried onions, and some spices. There were also 2,000 Maria Theresa dollars, which weighed very heavily, 300 rounds of spare ammunition, my small box of medicines, and about 50 gallons of water in 14 small skins. I knew already that several of these skins sweated badly, but had not been able to get others from the Tsar. Even so, I reckoned that if we rationed ourselves to a quart each for every day, and to a quart for cooking and coffee, we should be all right, even if we lost half our water from evaporation and leakage. This water was sweet, very different from the filthy stuff we had carried with us the year before. While we were busy dividing our stores into loads of suitable weight, Salih and Sada arrived, and I was glad to see that both their camels were powerful animals in good condition. We had decided the night before that we would load the spare camels heavily, at the risk of foundering them before we reached the Hasi, so as to save our mounts. I hoped that the two Tsar would be able to slip away unobserved from that well, even if the rest of us were detained, and it was therefore important that their camels should be spared as much as possible. They must carry only the lightest loads, if they carried anything at all. I gave them the rifles which I had promised, and 50 rounds of ammunition each. Their friends, who had come with them, examined these weapons critically, but could find nothing wrong. I had already presented Muhammad and Amir each with a rifle and 100 rounds of ammunition. Bin Gabesha had the rifle I had given him in Saiwun, Bin Kabina the one I had given him the year before, and I had my sporting 303. So we were a well-armed party. The others returned from the well, and we loaded the camels. The sun was warmer now, and I felt more cheerful, reassured by the good spirits of my companions, who laughed and joked as they worked. Before leaving, we climbed the rocky hill near the well, and Sada's uncle, a scrawny old man in a loincloth, showed us once more the direction to follow, pointing with both his arms. With his wild hair, gaunt face, and outstretched arms, he looked, I thought, like a prophet predicting doom. I was almost surprised when he said in an ordinary voice that we could not go wrong, as we should have the Arad escarpment on our left when we reached the Jilida. Standing behind him, I took a bearing with my compass. As we climbed down the hill, Ali told me that there had been another fight between the Yam and the Karab near Al-Abr 2 days before, and that the Bin Maruf had now decided to abandon Manwak and to move tomorrow to the Makia. He said that this was why there were already so many Arabs filling their skins at the well. We were leaving only just in time. The camels lurched their feet as we took hold of the head ropes. And, after each of the Rashid had tied a spare camel behind his own, we moved off on foot. The Tsar on the well stopped work to watch us go, and I wondered what they were saying. Ali came with us a short distance, and then, after embracing each of us in turn, went back. We had started on our journey. And, holding out our hands, we said together, I commit myself to God. 2 hours later, Sada pointed to the tracks of 5 camels that had been ridden ahead of us the day before. At first we wondered if they were yam, but after some discussion, Sada and Salih were convinced that they were Karab, and therefore friendly. Mohammed asked me to judge which was the best camel. I pointed at random to a set of tracks, and they all laughed, and said that I had picked out the one which was indubitably the worst. They then started to argue which really was the best. Although they had not seen these camels, they could visualize them perfectly. Amer, bin Gabesha, and Sada favored one camel. Muhammad, bin Gabina, and Salih, another. I knew nothing about Sada and Salih's qualifications, but felt sure that Amer and bin Gabesha were right, since they were better judges of a camel than Muhammad or bin Gabina. Not all Bedu can guide or track, and Muhammad was surprisingly bad at both. He was widely respected as the son of bin Kalut, and was inclined to be self-important in consequence. But really, he was the least efficient of my Rashid companions. Bin Gabesha was probably the most competent, and the others tended to rely on his judgment, as I did myself. He was certainly the best rider and the best shot, and always graceful in everything he did. He had a quick smile and a gentle manner, but I already suspected that he could be both reckless and ruthless. And I was not surprised when, within 2 years, he had become one of the most daring outlaws on the Tushil coast, with half a dozen blood feuds on his hands. Amir was equally ruthless, but he had none of Bin Gabesha's charm. He had a thin mouth, hard, unsmiling eyes, and a calculating spirit without warmth. I did not like him, but knew that he was competent and reliable. Travelling alone among these Bedu, I was completely at their mercy. They could at any times have murdered me, dumped my body in a sand drift, and gone off with my possessions. Yet so absolute was my faith in them that the thought that they might betray me never crossed my mind. We travelled through low limestone hills until nearly sunset, and camped in a cleft on their northern side. The Rashid did not trust the Tsar whom we had left at Manwak, so Amir went back along our tracks to keep watch until it was dark, while Bin Gabesha lay hidden on the cliff above us, watching the plain to the north, which was a highway for raiders going east or west. We started again at dawn, after an uneasy, watchful night, and soon after sunrise came upon a broad, beaten track, where Muzuk and the Abida had passed 2 days before. Bin Kabina and Amir stayed behind to try to identify some of the looted stock by reading the confusion in the sand. We had gone on a couple of miles when they caught up with us, laughing as they chased each other across the plain. They appeared to be in the best of spirits, and I was surprised when Bin Kabina told me that he had recognized the tracks of 2 of his 6 camels among the spoil. He had left these 2 animals with his uncle on the steppes. Luckily, Kwamakwam, the splendid camel on which he had crossed the empty quarter the year before, and the other 3 were with his brother at Habarut. He told us which animals they had been able to identify, but said that there had been so many animals that it was only possible to pick out a few that had travelled on the outskirts of the herd. As I listened, I thought once again how precarious was the existence of the Bedu. Their way of life naturally made them fatalists. So much was beyond their control. It was impossible for them to provide for a morrow when everything depended on a chance fall of rain, or when raiders, sickness, or any one of 100 chance happenings might, at any time, leave them destitute or end their lives. They did what they could, and no people were more self-reliant. But if things went wrong, they accepted their fate without bitterness, and with dignity as the will of God. We rode across gravel steps which merged imperceptibly into the sands of the Uruk al-Zazar. By midday, the north-east wind was blowing in tearing gusts, bitter cold but welcome, as it would wipe out our tracks and secure us from pursuit. We pressed on until night, hoping in vain to find grazing, and then groped about in the dark feeling for firewood. Here it was dangerous to light a fire after dark, but we were too cold and hungry to be cautious. We found a small hollow, lit a fire, and sat gratefully around the flames. At dawn we ate some dates, drank a few drops of coffee, and started off as the sun rose. It was another cold, grey day, but there was no wind. We went on foot for the first hour or two, and then each of us, as he felt inclined, pulled down his camel's head, put a foot on her neck, and was lifted up to within easy reach of the saddle. Muhammad was usually the first to mount, and I the last, for the longer I walked, the shorter time I should have to ride. The others varied their positions, riding astride or kneeling in the saddle, but I could only ride astride, and as the hours crawled by, the saddle edge bit deeper into my thighs. For the next 2 days, we crossed hard, flat, drab-coloured sands, without grazing, and consequently had no reason to stop until evening. On the second day, just after we had unloaded, we saw a bull oryx walking straight towards us. To him, we were in the eye of the setting sun, and he probably mistook us for others of his kind. As only about 3 Englishmen have ever shot an Arabian oryx, I whispered to Bin Gabesha to let me shoot, while the oryx came steadily on. Now he was only 1/4 mile away, now 300 yards, and still he came on. The size of a small donkey, I could see his long, straight horns, 2 feet or more in length, his pure white body, and the dark markings on his legs and face. He stopped suspiciously, less than 200 yards away. Bin Kabina whispered to me to shoot. Slowly I pressed the trigger. The oryx spun round and galloped off. Muhammad muttered disgustedly, "A clean miss!" And Bin Kabina said loudly, "If you had let Bin Gabesha shoot, we should have had meat for supper." All I could say was, "Damn and blast!" I little realized at the time that by missing the oryx, I probably saved our lives. 1 year later, Bin al-Kamam joined us on the Trucial coast. He told us that he had been at Main, in the Jauf, when news arrived that the Christian and some Rashid were at Manwak, preparing to cross the sands. The governor of the Jauf, Saif al-Islam al-Hussein, one of the Imam Yahya's sons, sent off 2 parties of Dam to kill us. The larger party of 20 occupied some wells on the desert's edge, which they thought we might visit, while the other party of 15 went into the sands to pick up our tracks. Bin al-Kamam said that he and his companion had been imprisoned to prevent them from escaping and giving us warning. He had been certain that the Dam would intercept and kill us, and when eventually he saw them riding back across the plain towards the town, he was waiting to hear that we were dead. Suddenly he realized that they were riding in silence, instead of singing their war songs, and that they must have failed to find us. The smaller party reported that they had picked up our tracks, which were 2 days old. They had followed us for 2 days, but as we were travelling very fast, they had been afraid that they would run out of water before they could overtake us. They said that, at our camping places, they had seen marks in the sand where we had put down our bags of gold. If I had shot the oryx, we should have delayed for 1 day to dry its meat, and the dam would probably have caught up with us. We thought at the time that we were far enough into the empty quarter to be safe, and we were not keeping a good lookout. If our pursuers had been from the Yam, they would certainly have overtaken us. But the dam are afraid of the sands. For the next 3 days, we rode across sands where there were only occasional abal bushes and a few dry tufts of alki or cassis, the remains of vegetation which had grown after rain 4 years before. We were now in the Kayamiyat, where parallel dune chains ran from northeast to southwest. These dunes were only about 150 feet high, but their steep inclines faced towards us, and the successive floundering ascents exhausted our camels, as they had eaten practically nothing for 6 days. When we left Manwak, they were very fat, and this gave them reserves on which to draw. But their very fatness distressed them in this heavy sand. They were fresh from pasturage, and their backs were soft and unaccustomed to the saddle. Now they were heavily loaded and doing very long marches. We knew that under such conditions they were certain to develop saddle swellings, which would turn all too easily into ulcers. We would gladly have rested them for 1 day if we could have found grazing, and if our water supply had allowed it. The sheepskins, which I had bought in ignorance, sweated very badly, but we had already finished the water that was in them. Even the goatskins had not been long enough in use to become watertight,